Hello and welcome to Ox Talk on Tuesday the 22nd of July 2025. My name's Simon and I'll be compiling this week's edition in which you will hear a selection of news items from the local Oxford papers read by Kristen Dennison, Judith Piggott and David Field. We shall also hear an excerpt from Kenneth Graham's Wind in the Willows. Copying and distribution of the USBs is by Michelle Lawful. Before we start, here is some information on how to listen to OxTalk on your Alexa device. At the end of the news, you can hear information on how to access OxTalk online.
Notice to listeners of OxTalk who use a smart speaker to access our service. There are new instructions for anyone who listens to OxTalk using Alexa. To listen to OxTalk in this way, you now have to use the Talking Newspaper skill. First, you need to enable it. Simply say, Alexa, enable Talking Newspaper. Then, to listen to OxTalk, please follow this procedure. Alexa, open Talking Newspaper.
Welcome to your Talking Newspaper skill. Please say the name of a newspaper, or a town or city you would like to hear from.
Oxford.
Here are the following newspapers nearest to Oxford. Please pick a newspaper name. Oxford and District Talking News, Whitney Talking News Latest Edition, Whitney Talking News Previous Edition, Whitney Talking Magazine, Wallingford, and District Talking Newspaper. Or do you want to hear more?
Oxford and District Talking News.
Do you want to listen to Oxford and District Talking News?
Yes.
This is Oxford and District Talking News.
If you have problems listening to OxTalk in this way, it could be due to the way that your Alexa device is set up. Please check the settings with whoever set up your device in the first place. If you still have problems, please contact OxTalk and we will try to help.
Tributes have been paid to a local footballer who died in the Thames. The body of a 23-year-old man named William was found on Sunday after he got into difficulty after entering the river at Buscott Lock near Farringdon the previous evening. While Thames Valley Police did not initially release his full name, the force has now confirmed the man was Will Coker after tributes poured in online. Police launched an extensive search lasting over 12 hours to try and find Mr. Coker. Officers confirm the death is not being treated as suspicious. Commenting on Sunday, Temporary Chief Superintendent Liz Knight said, "Extensive searches were taken to locate William, and I am saddened to confirm that we have located a young man's body. William's family have been kept updated throughout the day. An investigation will be conducted on behalf of the Oxfordshire coroner, but we do not believe the death to be suspicious. I would like to offer my sincere thanks to all agencies who have assisted us with our search throughout the day. It is a very tragic outcome, and my thoughts and the thoughts of all of us at Thames Valley Police remain with William's family at this extremely distressing time. He played football for both Carlton Town FC and Highworth Town FC in Wiltshire. Both clubs have since paid tribute to him. A GoFundMe page has also been set up by Otis Lewis to pay for funeral expenses and support Will's family. Emergency services have reiterated the importance of water safety after William lost his life in the River Thames. Oxfordshire Fire and Rescue Service warns that activities that are known to lead to the highest number of fatalities are swimming, jumping or diving in. Deb Forder, Safety Manager for Oxfordshire County Council's Fire and Rescue Service, said, "Open water can look appealing, but it is also very dangerous. That is why the practical advice we're offering is so important, particularly during the summer when the residents are more likely to be tempted to take a dip. Please consider such things as letting friends and family know your route near water and what time you should return. Carry a whistle to draw attention if you do get into difficulties. If you fall in, remember to relax, lean back and float until you can control your breathing. The fire service warns that there are other dangers of open water, including hidden dangers below the surface that could make people ill, cause injury and even kill. This could be anything from large rocks to machinery, shopping trolleys to branches, and even fish hooks or a broken fishing line. The fire service warned the temperature of the water in a reservoir, quarry or lake can remain very cold, and that the low water temperature can numb limbs and claim lives. It added that moving water, such as rivers, might look calm. However, there could be strong currents below the surface.
Troubled Thames water has revealed it slumped to a £1.65 billion annual loss and saw its mammoth Death Mountain balloon higher. This comes after the company became the latest supplier to announce a hosepipe ban, which will begin on the 22nd of July for customers in Oxfordshire, Gloucestershire, most of Wiltshire, and some parts of Berkshire. The utility tumbled to the pre-tax loss in the year to March 31st from profits of £175 million the previous year after it booked a £1.27 billion bad debt provision on intercompany loans and set aside £122 million for fines from Ofwat, among other costs. Results from Britain's biggest water supplier showed its net debt swelled by another £1.65 billion to £16.79 billion by the end of March. It also revealed a disappointing performance on pollution, with incidents surging by over a third, 34.3%, to 470. The figures come as the water firm, which has 16 million customers, remains locked in talks over a rescue funding deal with senior creditors after private equity firm KKR last month pulled out of plans to inject £4 billion of much-needed cash. Chris Weston, chief executive of Thames Water, said, "Pollutions were adversely impacted by rainfall and high groundwater levels, but we have made progress in terms of addressing many of the underlying causes of our poor performance, including being more proactive in sewer cleaning. While it is disappointing this work was not reflected in performance improvement in the year, we are confident that it will translate into future environmental performance." Its bosses are set for a grilling by MPs on the 22nd of July after being recalled by the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, EFRA, committee to answer questions on bonuses for senior executives and the group's plans for a rescue deal. It recently emerged that £2.5 million of bonuses paid to senior Thames Water executives in April under a controversial retention scheme cannot be recovered by regulators. Annual results for Thames Water showed that on an underlying basis, it swung to a pre-tax loss of £6 million from profits of £204 million the previous year as revenues lifted by over 8%. The debt levels highlight the extent of Thames Water's creaking finances as it looks to secure vital funding and to stave off nationalization by the government. Mr. Weston said, "We recognize that our current gearing is too high and, to address this, we are progressing with our senior creditors' plans to recapitalize the business, which will see us return to a more stable financial foundation. This will come with a requirement to reset the regulatory landscape and acknowledge it will take at least a decade to turn Thames around." Thames Water added that the recapitalization process remains ongoing, but insisted it was in an improved position compared to 6 months ago, and our creditors have been supportive throughout the process.
Thames Water has announced a hosepipe ban on millions of its customers, which will come into force this month. The temporary ban is to come in for all Oxfordshire residents, starting from midnight on Tuesday of next week. No date has been given for an end to the ban at this stage. Customers with the OX, GL, SN, RG4, RG8 and RG9 postcodes are affected. After the driest spring in over a century and England's warmest June on record, The Thames Valley area has been placed in prolonged dry weather status by the Environment Agency. This means there is a heightened risk of drought. Oxfordshire residents are being asked not to use hose pipes, including for cleaning cars, watering gardens or allotments, filling paddling pools and swimming pools, or cleaning windows. While the ban does not impact businesses where water is used in a core part of their purpose, Thames Water is asking everyone across the region it serves to be mindful of their water use. According to Thames Water, usage in Oxfordshire has been up 30% on days where temperatures are above 25 degrees Celsius. Water from the River Thames is stored at Farmore Reservoir. If, as is expected, the warm, dry weather continues, the company anticipates that reservoir levels at Farmore will continue to drop. In the Cotswolds, aquifers which feed the River Thames are fast draining, and the prolonged low rainfall also limits how quickly they can be refilled, further restricting how much water the company can source for reservoir storage. Neville Muncaster, Strategic Water Resources Director at Thames Water, said, "This has been a challenging spring and summer, with big spikes in customer demand during hot, dry days and very little rainfall to replenish local supplies in the Thames Valley area. Given the continued warm, dry weather, we do not anticipate that the situation will improve any time soon, so we have to take action now. Every drop of water we use comes from the environment, and we have to balance protecting this while taking out the water needed to top up reservoir levels. That is why we have to make the difficult decision to implement a hosepipe ban, to make sure there's enough water for customers' essential needs and to protect rivers. While this temporary use ban will only affect customers in certain areas, I want to thank all our customers for their understanding and for their support so far to reduce their water usage. This includes turning the taps off while brushing teeth, taking shorter showers, and letting your lawn go dry."
Final push to save vital community arts hub in Oxford. The future is looking bright for a vital community arts hub in North Oxford. More than £400,000 is raised to save it, but a final push is needed. Summertown United Reformed Church in Banbury Road closed for worship in 2022 after 179 years, but is still used extensively by local arts groups for classes, workshops and rehearsals in dance, drama, music and visual arts, as well as by visiting churches, Summertown Church Partnership and other community groups. After the closure of Summertown URC, the Wessex Synod Trust, which owns the building, continued to hire out the premises to community groups, but announced in December 24 that it intended to sell it. Following this, a group of users came together as Summertown Arts Community, or SAC, to raise money to buy the premises. The SAC became a charity in June. The building is registered with Oxford City Council as an asset of heritage value, and SAC registered it as an asset of community value, or ACV. Under the terms of the ACV, SAC had 6 months from the end of January to put together a credible offer, and the group were given until July the 28th to buy it. Darshan Sandrashka, a trustee of SAC, said that this was no longer a burning deadline, as they have put in a bid of £850,000 to buy it, which has been accepted, if they can raise the money. Since then, the team have worked around the clock to raise the money. In just 45 days, they have raised an impressive £425,000. "We have not slept," said Mr. Sandrashka. "We are at a point where we would love it if we could raise the rest from the community. We need another £75,000 to £100,000 to put a deposit down and get a small mortgage. It's just the final push now." Mr. Sandrashka stressed how important it is that the asset, which he described as a heartbeat in North Oxford, can be secured and kept away from being another soulless place. There is no other community arts hub in North Oxford, he said. Oxford is losing all its cultural spaces bit by bit. This is a place where a six-year-old can dance while a grandfather can do a watercolour class next door. Where else is this kind of stuff happening anymore? Mr. Zandrachka said the community spirit had been amazing, adding, it has really shown how much the community cares. SAC will host two fundraising events at the Hub on Saturday, July the 26th, which is an improvisation day, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m, offering a range of music, art, dance and poetry. And on the Sunday, the 27th of July, there is a performance at 7 p.m. from the pianist Victoria Dormelo. The Just Giving page and more information about SAC can be found on their website, which is summertownarts, or one word, .co.uk.
Oxford City Council has officially opposed a suggested congestion charge following a heated debate. Councillors discussed a motion from the Labour Group at a full meeting on Monday, July 14, calling for the Council to express its opposition to the congestion charge scheme. Announced last month, the proposal from Oxfordshire County Council, OCC, would see a temporary £5 charge for motorists who drive through several roads in the city, including Thames Street and Marston Ferry Road, without a permit. Prior to the motion opposing the charge being debated, councillors were addressed by Richard Parnham, part of the campaign group Reconnecting Oxford, which calls for the implementation of evidence-based policies. He said, legal action should be considered against OCC for dreaming up a scheme which is objectively bonkers. Mr. Parnham cited several examples of what he viewed as the scheme's inconsistency, such as Marston Ferry Road being within the congestion charge zone, but Marsh Lane, which is often absolutely rammed, not. The motion itself was proposed by Labour Councillor James Taylor and seconded by his colleague Asima Kayum. Councillor Taylor said the biggest problem with the scheme was that it is inequitable. He said the problem with the proposed scheme is that it is not a congestion charge. What the Oxfordshire County Council is proposing is to essentially turn six of Oxford's main roads into toll roads. The councillor added that it will be people within poor areas of the city that will be most impacted. It is a scheme that seems particularly drawn up to aid the wealthy, he said. This and the lack of proper engagement with the City Council about the congestion charge were the two main critiques from the Labour Group. Defending the proposal from OCC, which is run by the Lib Dems, Councillor Christopher Smoten said the congestion charge would support bus transport. The leader of the city's Lib Dems said that despite Oxford's narrow streets, the numbers of cars grows year after year. Stressing that the money raised from the charge would be reinvested into public transport, he said that it would help those on lower incomes who make up most bus users. He added, as a city, do we or do we not back our buses? Councillor Alex Powell of the Green Party, which supports the charge, said Labour were hypocritical for challenging it. Why is the Labour Group, he said, which a year ago made the case for urgent action, now calling for a motion that opposes the very action they called for? A petition has been launched to oppose the Council's proposal for Oxfordshire Waste Centre changes. The Police and Crime Commissioner for the Thames Valley, Matthew Barber, said Oxfordshire County Council's plans will inevitably lead to more fly-tipping and waste crime. He launched a petition to oppose the scheme, claiming many people said they didn't have any faith in the Council consultation. The commissioner voiced his opposition to the booking system for recycling centres in the county, a policy which will be introduced this year, as well as proposed changes including reducing opening days to 5 per week and daily hours. Other policies being considered include proof of residence in Oxfordshire to dump waste, a ban for vehicles with business branding, and requiring more people to obtain a permit and limiting them to 6 visits per year. Commissioner Matthew Barber said, I've talked about the Oxfordshire County Council's plans to make it harder for people to use our local recycling centres, which will inevitably lead to more fly-tipping and waste crime. Now I've launched a petition to oppose the changes. So many people that responded said they didn't have any faith in the council consultation.
Major changes have been announced for buses across Oxford and Oxfordshire. Oxfordshire County Council and the bus operators have been awarded £10,146,500 £513 for 2025-26 to improve services. Just over half of the funding will go towards improving journey times and reliability, including smart traffic signals and dedicated bus lanes. Upgraded infrastructure, such as real-time passenger information displays and improvements to bus stops and interchanges, and vehicle improvement grants to help operators invest in cleaner, more comfortable and technologically advanced buses, is also included in that half. The rest will support the continuation of routes like the 64 between Whitney and Swindon, the 500 between Bicester, Brackley and Banbury, and the X34 which runs between Harwell Campus and Newbury, all of which were funded by the original grant in 2022. It will also support improvements in August, including increasing the popular X32 and X40 services from Didcot and Reading to Oxford to every 20 minutes on weekdays, and providing new Sunday services in Bicester, Banbury and Chipping Norton. It will also fund simpler and more affordable fares, including the continuation of the popular My Bus Oxfordshire multi-operator ticket, support for vulnerable groups such as a 12-month extension of the free bus pass scheme for asylum seekers in Oxford. Improvements for passengers, including a countrywide bus stop audit, a new bus stop design guide, targeted marketing to raise awareness of services, and a pilot scheme to help school children build confidence in using the bus network, are also planned.
Developers have pledged £7 million for community facilities for a new estate in Kidlington, but critics have questioned how accessible the scheme will be for local families. Vistry Group has been given planning permission for 370 new homes off Vistry Road in Kidlington. The developer has pledged to provide large areas of new public open space, including sports pitches and play areas, with more than £7 million of developer contributions. Construction work is expected to start this autumn, with the first homes anticipated to be available from spring 2026. It comes as Kidlington has been inundated with planning applications for swathes of new housing, which critics fear will tear up the so-called Kidlington Gap between Oxford and the surrounding villages. Kidlington East County Councillor Ian Middleton suggested priority should be given to addressing Oxford's unmet housing need as a result of Charwell District Council's local plan partial review. He added, "This is former Kidlington Greenbelt land, but I don't believe the affordable element of the development will be available to local families. As far as I'm aware, Oxford's unmet housing need will be prioritized, not Kidlington's. Kidlington is a growing area, and we do need more sports pitches. We also need a bigger swimming pool and facilities for other sports." Vistry said 185 of the homes will be affordable tenures. The developer is in partnership with housing provider Paradigm Housing Group, which will own and manage the affordable homes once they have been built. Vistry has also sold 56 of the homes to Leaf Living, which provides professionally managed new build rental homes, with the remaining homes to be sold on the open market. Supriya Ray, Regional Managing Director of Vistry Cotswold, said, "Kidlington is a perfect example of Vistry's unique partner delivery model. Working with Paradigm and Leaf Living means we're able to provide 241 homes in affordable tenures alongside a significant number of quality homes for the build-to-rent market, whilst utilizing the strengths of our house building brand to sell the remaining homes on the open market. This approach provides the greatest range of housing choices, giving local people genuine opportunities to own or rent a quality new home in a popular Oxfordshire town." Martin Jones, Paradigm Housing's Executive Director for Development and Sales, said, "Paradigm has had early and effective involvement in the planning process, meaning this was more than a simple acquisition and much more of a partnership with Vistry, enabling us to influence design and placemaking."
The closure date for a post office and supermarket in Oxford has been confirmed as redevelopment plans progress. Headington Post Office and the Co-op Food will shut in January next year. the Mid-Counties Cooperative has confirmed, as the building is demolished and redeveloped for labs and offices. The building at 152 London Road was bought by developer Kante Estates in 2020, and the Co-op and Post Office have remained on the site, operating under a lease since then. Several refused or withdrawn planning applications have revealed something of the developer's plans for the site, which currently include demolishing the retail store and building 2 to 3 story building with a basement instead. These would form research and development offices, although originally the company submitted parallel applications for the same site for a 92-bed hotel and a separate bid for a life science facility. Mid-Counties Cooperative sold to the developer in 2020 after indicating to customers the store did not fit the long-term strategy of the society, but hoped to operate a smaller store on-site following the redevelopment. A spokesperson for Mid-Counties Cooperative said, "Redevelopment plans have now been submitted by the owners, which no longer include space for a retail offering. We will therefore be vacating in January 2026 when our lease comes to an end. Our Headington Your Co-op food store, Co-op Travel branch and post office have been an important part of the community, and we are therefore committed to exploring all options for alternative suitable sites within the local area so that each business can continue to serve as many local members and customers as possible. More than 40 comments have objected to the plan so far, alongside a public petition launched calling the company to save Headington Post Office. The petition said, "Labour councillors and campaigners and Annalisa Dodds MP have worked hard to keep this post office open for many years. Trish Elphinstone first campaigned to keep a post office in Headington back in 2021, with her petition reaching over 1,000 signatures. We have set up a new petition to reflect the ongoing amount of community support for the post office to remain in Headington." Oxfordshire County Councillor Trish Elphinstone, one of the original campaigners, commented on the planning application. She said, "Where is the promised retail space for a shop and post office? This is not good enough. The community was promised there would be jobs for locals in the shop and that the post office would continue within the space. Do the right thing and give something back to Headington community, like Kante and the post office said they would." Headington Co-op originally opened in 1892 on the corner of Windmill Road, moving to its current shop in 1979. The post office moved inside the shop in February 2016 and Co-op Travel in September 2021.
Sports editor Liam Rice traveled to Indonesia to cover Oxford United's pre-season tour. Today, he relishes an unusual spectacle involving the U's head coach and a lion. What was shaping up to be the first relatively low-key day of Oxford United's trip to Indonesia, in fact, turned out to be one of the most unforgettable days of my journalism career. The day revolves around what will become a famed press conference in United folklore. We were informed in the morning that there would be a 2 p.m. start at the Gedung Sate building, the office for the governor of West Java. In impressive and majestic surroundings, it was an unusual location for a press conference, which only kicked into gear at approximately 2:45 p.m. We've already learned, though, that Indonesians are quite laid back when it comes to start and finish times, and there's something to be said for the overwhelmingly positive mindsets and nature of people. While waiting at the side, we were introduced to Maruarar Sirait, the housing minister of Indonesia, and welcomed by him as if we were British dignitaries here in Bandung. That was strange, but it was only about to get a whole lot weirder. The press conference itself began at a slow pace, my very limited Indonesian meaning I missed the jokes of a comedian, prior to a belting rendition of the national anthem and various presentations and speeches. Questions were directed at players and coaching staff, with one representative from each club and U's head coach Gary Rowett on behalf of United. In the full heat of the Indonesian afternoon, the press conference then heated up even more and came alive in the most unexpected fashion. Dancers first put on a lively show in front of us, with traditional music blasting from various instruments. And then came the piece de resistance, as the minister and colleagues climbed aboard a stuffed model lion with four men holding the platform below. They were whisked away from the stage amid exuberant dancing and performed a loop in front of the gathered media. After 2 minutes or so, it was time for the players and coaches to be invited on to the lion, and to his credit, although he took a tentative step forward, Rowett seemed to get into the swing of things and embraced the moment despite the bewildering festivities around him. Rowett was paraded from side to side as photographers and journalists rushed to capture the moment, and despite the understandably awkward look on his face as the lion jolted forward at times, Rowett managed to style out the 2 minutes for the most part. When safely back on the ground, Rowett was back in familiar territory as he faced more questions from the media, but as far as press conferences go, nothing will ever come close to topping it. Oxford United do not yet have a time scale on the ankle injury suffered by Ole Romney during the President's Cup tournament in Indonesia. Romney was forced off on a stretcher shortly after scoring the second goal in United's 4-0 victory against Arema FC on Thursday. The Indonesia international was then unavailable for the final, as the U's were beaten 2-1 by Thai side Port FC, with the second half paused for more than 20 minutes due to monsoon-like conditions. Talking about the injury to Romney in the post-game press conference, United head coach Gary Rowett said, "I don't know the exact timescale. It looks quite a bad injury, so it wasn't one that was very pleasing for us to lose someone like Ole. I'm sure for the national team as well, and the way that we lost him with the tackle. It was a poor tackle at the time, but we'll assess it and we'll see what that timescale looks like." Rowett added, "When you're playing competitive matches, the matches mean an awful lot to everybody. You could see for Port FC the way they celebrated. It was an important victory for them. But of course, I said this is our preseason, so injuries are not what we want at this stage, but we have to deal with it."
A family fun day will be held to celebrate a Headington Sport and Social Club's 75th year. Viking Sports and Social Club, Old High Street, invites the community to join the festivities on Saturday, 26th of July, from noon to midnight. The club has organised activities including children's entertainment, a barbecue, refreshments, a tombola, a raffle, a pool, and Aunt Sally knockout competition. The day will also feature a mini beer festival, bingo, and a disco. The club was founded in 1950 as an independent football club by former Regal Youth Club players. As membership increased, it extended its activities to include cricket, table tennis, basketball, and mixed hockey. It now functions as a private members club with membership of more than 200, ranging from teenagers to people in their 90s. Guests are also welcomed, and fundraising plays a significant role in maintaining and growing the club. The Viking Club hosts a variety of sporting activities and social events. It is home to teams competing in countrywide leagues, including table tennis, bar billiards, pool, Aunt Sally and crib teams. It also hosts a weekly bingo night, music and karaoke nights, quiz and race nights, and monthly raffles. Fusion Dance Academy also operates in the club, offering a range of dance classes for all ages.
Two Cotswolds charities have received a £25,000 donation following a recent house draw in the area. The beneficiaries are Cirencester Housing for Young People, CHYP, which supports vulnerable 16 to 25-year-olds facing homelessness, and Cotswolds Friends, a long-standing charity providing essential services for older and vulnerable members of the community. OMAS was introduced to both charities by Sir Geoffrey Clifton Brown, MP, Member of Parliament for the North Cotswolds. The donation follows OMAS's recent house draw in the Cotswolds, which saw 25-year-old Clarkson's Farm fan Anthony Martin win a 5-bedroom property worth £5 million along with £250,000 in cash. This draw also raised £4.2 million for guide dogs. OMAS has a commitment to leaving a lasting legacy in the communities where its grand prize houses are located, in addition to the main donation for its house draw charity partners, and is delighted to be supporting these two very worthy local causes. CHYP has been operating for nearly 40 years and provides round-the-clock support along with an individual plan for each young resident to make sure their needs are met and that they are moving towards living independently. Most of CHYP's vulnerable young residents are homeless as a result of family breakup, abuse, or leaving care. Many have additional problems such as special educational needs or mental health issues. In recent years, CHYP has seen a significant rise in the number of young people presenting with complex mental health challenges, now affecting 80 to 90% of its residents. In response, the charity has reviewed its accommodation and services and is developing a new unit. The current house will be dedicated to the youngest and most vulnerable residents, while the new space, supported in part by the £12,500 OMAS donation, will provide a home for more independent 20 to 25-year-olds who require less intensive support. Planning discussions with senior council officials are already underway. Cotswolds Friends has been working to alleviate loneliness and isolation, improve health and well-being, and support independent living for more than 45 years. Over 2,300 people benefit from the services, delivered by over 340 volunteers and a staff team. The charity will use the £12,500 donation to support its community activities program, CAP. It costs Cotswold Friends around £300 per person to support lonely, isolated older people, meaning the much-needed new funds will support more than 40 people attending community activities for a year. CAP offers many activities, including friendship cafes, lunch clubs, day clubs, knit and natter sessions, community singing, walking football, a community garden, and men in sheds, all designed to bring people together and support well-being across the Cotswolds. Sir Geoffrey Clifton Brown, MP for North Cotswolds, said, "Across the Cotswolds, charities and volunteers contribute so much to our community, providing support and services to those who need it most. It was a wonderful opportunity to meet with OMAS and introduce them to these two amazing organizations."
Oxfordshire jobs could be at risk under plans by the National Trust to cut staff. The number of job cuts, if any, in the county has not been decided, with proposals subject to formal consultation. But it is estimated that around 6% of roles are likely to be made redundant across the Trust's entire workforce. Around 550 people are at risk of redundancy nationally after the National Trust told staff it wanted to reduce its pay bill and find savings worth £26 million. A spokeswoman told this newspaper, "There are no plans to close any houses, which in Oxfordshire includes Grays Court and Nuffield Place near Henley, Chastleton House near Chipping Norton, and Upton House near Banbury. But some places' opening hours may change to reflect demand, but this is quite normal," she added. The spokeswoman said, "The restructure is across the whole organisation, including Oxfordshire. We need to respond to the economic environment affecting all charities, including rising inflation and cost of living and extra financial pressures, such as the rise in National Insurance Employers' Contribution and the National Living Wage. This year we launched our new 10-year strategy, shaped by more than 70,000 members and other stakeholders. It commits us to three main aims: restore nature, end unequal access to nature and cultural heritage, and inspire millions of people. The restructure will ensure the Trust's long-term sustainability and ability to deliver our charitable goals. Recent increases to employer national insurance contributions and the national minimum wage have added more than £10 million to its annual wage bill, the charity said. The tax hike was a central tenet of Chancellor Rachel Reeves' autumn budget to raise billions of pounds for the Treasury. Steve Thomas, Deputy General Secretary of Trade Union Prospect, said the proposed cuts will bring huge uncertainty and worry for staff. We understand the cost pressures the Trust is facing, but management decisions, as well as external factors, have contributed to the financial situation. And once again, it is our members who will have to pay the price, he said. Our members are custodians of the country's cultural, historic, and natural heritage. Cuts of this scale risk losing institutional knowledge and skills, which are vital to that mission. Prospect will be working with the National Trust to try to minimise the negative impact of these cuts on both workers and on the operation of the Trust. The charity has begun a 45-day consultation period with its staff. A decision will be made after the results are analysed.
King Charles has spoken of a very special addition to Oxford during a visit to the city. The monarch visited the Oxford Centre for Islamic Studies in Marston Road, Headington, on Thursday, where he has been a patron of since 1993. Addressing those at the centre, the king called the centre remarkable as it celebrated 40 years. During his visit, he spoke to the centre as well as to Oxford University Chancellor William Hague and centre director Farhan Nizami. King Charles visited the centre in the afternoon after holding an audience with the President of the Maldives, Mohamed Mouzou, at Windsor Castle earlier in the day. He said, "In this milestone anniversary year, I can only say that it is with enormous pride and admiration that I join you all here today to pay tribute to this remarkable centre as it celebrates four decades of unfailing work to broaden our understanding of the Islamic world in the United Kingdom. From its humble beginnings in 1985, when both Dr. Nizami and I had slightly fewer grey hairs, I have seen the centre grow from a modest hut on St. Cross Road into an internationally renowned institution now housed in these spectacular surroundings, hosting a plethora of fascinating speakers over the years, creating countless opportunities for young and old alike, and forging lifelong friendships along the way." The Oxford Centre for Islamic Studies, which is in Marston Road, was founded in 1985 and is dedicated to the study of Islamic culture. In May 2017, the centre marked its official opening at its new £100 million base after founding three decades before that. The King added, "The centre's ongoing commitment to objective scholarship and international cooperation, underpinned by principles of dialogue, deep understanding, and mutual respect, is more imperative than ever in today's world. I need hardly say I am extremely heartened that the center continues to play such a significant role in that globally critical endeavor." Indeed, the spark of ambition with which the center was founded all those years ago remains undimmed. Therefore, as we mark this 40th anniversary year, it is with great optimism that I look forward to the next chapter of the center's story, building upon what it has already achieved with the same enduring values that has fortified the institution thus far. So I can only thank you, Dr. Nizami, along with so many of the illustrious group gathered here today, who have each supported the center over the years, and of course the eminent architect of this very special addition to Oxford's townscape, for your tireless dedication and unswerving vision, which have shaped the center into the beacon of Islamic scholarship that it is today. It means more to me than you can imagine to be sharing the stage with you once again in the company of so many familiar faces and friends, and to join in the celebrations as a particularly proud patron. A student's journey of resilience has been recognized with a top honor at a college awards ceremony. Freya Crawford, a first-year performing arts student at Abingdon and Whitney College, was named Overall Student of the Year at the college's annual Student of the Year Awards held at Blenheim Palace on Monday, July 7th. Ms. Crawford originally joined the college on a Level 2 award to balance her studies with family responsibilities. She progressed quickly, completing a Level 3 diploma with distinction. Calum James, lecturer and progress coach at Abingdon and Whitney College, said, "Freya has consistently demonstrated an exceptional level of commitment, professionalism, and creativity throughout the year. She leads by example, supports her peers, and continues to grow with every opportunity. Her work ethic is outstanding, and her performances are a reflection of both her talent and her dedication to her craft. She is an absolute credit to the college and the Performing Arts Department." The awards ceremony celebrates outstanding achievement across the college's 11 faculties, with just 22 students recognized out of nearly 14,000 enrolled.
The family of a founding pupil at a city school have donated £8,000 for a project set to benefit staff and pupils. Eileen Penhall, née Cater, was 5 years old when Botley School gates first flung open in April 1938. She died aged 91 late last year in Spain, where she had long retired to, because she always spoke fondly of her former school. And now, thanks to an £8,000 donation from her family, Botley School is inaugurating a reflection space and an outdoor classroom in the central courtyard, or quad, of the original 1930s building on July the 15th. Carl Penhall, Eileen's son, said, "Mum was talking about Botley School until the very day before she died last year at 91 and three quarters. The teachers, school friends, and crocodile-shaped chocolates Miss Woodward gave them as a reward for good work were never far from her mind. The school was clearly transformational for Mum, and in later life she loved nature, gardens and kids. She would have loved this project." In recent years, the quad at Botley School had become overgrown and unusable for pupils, but it has now been redesigned with planting plans and seating as a calm and welcoming reflection zone for pupils and staff. It will be a safe space which can be used for outside learning, breakout areas, or contemplation, and to aid staff and pupil well-being. The school was unable to afford an initial sky-high quote for a contractor to do the work. Undeterred, staff and parents came up with a workaround. Amazing parents and volunteers installed weed-suppressing membranes, shoveled tons of ornamental shingle, and created a garden. Headteacher Joe Reed said, "In recent years we have seen a surge in emotional and mental health issues within our school community. So having a safe, calm and welcoming space for reflection and quiet outdoor activities is crucially important to our pupils. I cannot thank the Penhall family and our amazing volunteers enough for their generosity of time and finances to bring this quad back to being a central part of our school. We would also like to thank the Hope Fennell Trust, Gaze Burville and AWBS for their support. The early years of Eileen, who lived in nearby Arthray Road, and her fellow pupils were shaped by the events of World War II, which included the arrival of evacuee children. Botley School was their safe space. Another quad, reimagined as this reflection zone, also provides a safe space for today's pupils as they face the challenge of growing up in these fast-changing times."
Readers have been sending in their recollections of memorable coach trips, including Barry Eastman, who provided a picture of a bus outing to Eastbourne in 1953 with his mother Phyllis and father Harold. The column brought back childhood and teenage memories for Anne Lake, who remembers Sunday school and chapel choir trips to the seaside, which were enjoyable even in the rain. Anne said, "I remember returning from one trip to the lakes when we stopped in Kirkby Stephen to find two other coaches from other chapels from our area, and we all stood and sang all in the April evening. I always remember that trip when I hear the song. On most of the trips, we had crisps, which were made by our local fish shop, and small bottles of Wood and Watson's Pop. Charles Turner took his love of bus trips a step further and became a coach driver. He recalled, "It was always satisfying taking people on holiday, especially kids who had never seen the sea before." In the late 80s, Charles drove further afield to European destinations. He added, "At the time, you could get a cheap 7-day holiday to Spain by coach, but what people did not realize is that it took 2 days to get there and 2 days to return, so you only had 3 days in Spain."
Oxford University has explained why you might be seeing more ladybirds this summer. An influx of the creatures at Lord's in London distracted players and led to a brief pause in England's contest against India on the first day of the third Rothesay Test. In fact, ladybirds are being seen in very high numbers this year because of the warm weather. Tim Coulson, Professor of Zoology and Head of Biology at the University of Oxford, encouraged people to learn to love ladybirds. Warm weather means more aphids because they can complete each generation faster. Insects, including ladybirds and aphids, tend to speed up their lives in warm weather. He said, "Ladybirds eat aphids, and an abundance of aphids mean ladybirds have a lot to eat."
Butterflies in decline could get a boost from more trees and hedgerows on farmland, new research suggests. A study led by the University of Oxford and Butterfly Conservation has found that trees, hedgerows, and small woodlands significantly increase butterfly numbers in agricultural landscapes. Dr. Ruth Fieber, lead author from Oxford's Department of Biology, said, "We know that butterflies are in desperate trouble, including our common countryside species. Butterflies are important indicators of wider biodiversity, so actions to help butterflies will also help other declining wildlife. With 70% of the UK's land area being farmland, our farmers and landowners play a vital role in helping these species recover through protecting and restoring hedgerows and trees. The research, funded by the Woodland Trust and published in Ecological Solutions and Evidence, comes amid troubling news for UK butterflies, with more than half of the species now in long-time decline. The study found that butterfly species such as the speckled wood, gatekeeper, meadow brown, ringlet, and comma were more abundant in areas with greater numbers of trees and hedgerows. These features were especially valuable for butterfly populations in arable landscapes." The team analyzed 10 years of data from 1,154 1-kilometer squares across England, collected by volunteers through the Wider Countryside Butterfly Survey. Their findings showed that areas with more hedgerows and small woodlands supported higher numbers of butterflies. The study also included interviews with 31 farmers who recognized the benefits of trees and hedgerows, but raised concerns about the costs and long-term commitment required for their upkeep. Dr. Fieber said, "It is clear that farmers recognize the importance of these crucial habitats, but they need to be supported. We need to recognize that these trees and hedgerows provide public goods which benefit wildlife and people." The research forms part of a broader program by Oxford's Wildlife Conservation Research Unit, WildCRU, which explores the interaction between agriculture and wildlife. Dr. Fieber is currently investigating the effects of regenerative farming practices at the university's Northfield Farm, including mob grazing and field margin management. She said, "I am using butterflies as a model group to study whether this grazing system, together with field margin and hedgerow management, offers opportunities to enhance habitat quality and landscape connectivity for biodiversity." Ultimately, these findings could provide valuable insight into how policy incentives should be structured to support farmers undertaking management actions that deliver biodiversity benefits. The annual tradition of counting swans on the River Thames has begun and will reach Abingdon on Friday, July 18. The count, known as swan-upping, is the royal census of birds on the river and date back to the 12th century. It is designed to give an idea of the health of the swan population and is carried out every July. It began at Sunbury Lock in Middlesex on Monday, July 14th, and finishes at Abingdon Bridge on Friday, July 18th, passing through a number of places including Henley, Sunning, and Caversham. This year's Swan marker David Barber said the previous two counts had shown a downturn in cyclic numbers as a result of bird flu. Fortunately, there has been a decrease in reported cases of the disease in the River Thames area in recent months, he told the BBC. Calmer river conditions of recent weeks will also benefit young cygnets as they learn to navigate the waterways with their parents.
Two new and rather different exhibitions are opening in Oxford. An exhibition celebrating best-selling espionage author John le Carré is due to open in Oxford, showcasing the writer's annotated manuscripts and letters to friends. Le Carré, whose real name was David Cornwell, wrote spy novels including Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and The Night Manager, and died in December 2020, aged 89. The exhibition, titled John le Carré Tradecraft, will feature research, drafts, and corrections for his books, as well as original sketches, watercolour paintings, and letters to fans and friends. Among them is a letter from actor Sir Alec Guinness, which questioned his suitability to play George Smiley, Mr. Le Carré's best-known character, in which Sir Alec wrote that he was not really rotund and double-chinned. The author successfully convinced Sir Alec to accept the role in the TV series of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which aired in the late 1970s to considerable acclaim. Prior to his career as a writer, Mr. Le Carré worked in British intelligence throughout the 1950s and 60s. The display at the Western Library in the Bodleian Libraries will include material that spans Mr. Le Carré's time as an Oxford student to drafts written in his final weeks, and is the first time some of the archive will be displayed publicly. Nick Harkaway, author and son of Mr. Le Carré, said, "Oxford took my father in when he was desperate to escape his own father's malign influence and kept his place when he couldn't afford it. The Bodleian was his refuge then and his choice for his archive now. It feels like a homecoming." The exhibition's title plays on the term tradecraft, which Mr. Le Carré used to describe techniques of espionage, but may also be applied to his own craft as a writer and social commentator. Also, a new gallery inspired by video games is to open at the Story Museum in Oxford. The arcade charts landmark moments in gaming history and shows how evolving storytelling techniques lets players experience new emotional, social, cultural, and historical perspectives. The gallery also features games created by young designers from the Story Museum's Digital Dreamers program. Funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund, game makers worked with industry professionals to select stories from the museum's Digital 1001 collection and reimagined them as video games. The arcade invites children and parents to play, learn, and imagine together, celebrating how they share and experience stories in the digital age. The museum CEO, Caroline Jones, said, "The Story Arcade is a brand new gallery that explores another exciting realm of storytelling. Having travelled through 2,000 years of stories, from oral traditions in our Whispering Wood, through printed literature in our Enchanted Library, visitors will now step into an arcade like no other. We'll take them on a journey from the 1970s arcade classic Space Invaders to more recent games such as Never Alone, plus a whole heap of other activities and objects to explore in True Story Museum hands-on style. Thank you to all the National Lottery players for making this project possible. Game on."
A cancer survivor has raised more than £6,000 for charity after completing a 10K race less than a year after his diagnosis. Tim Field, 58, crossed the finish line at the TAME 10K in 54 minutes, just months after surgery and treatment for stage 2 bowel cancer. He was joined by 22 friends and family members on the day in a show of support. Mr. Field said, "For 12 years, this race has been a staple in my calendar and a personal challenge. This year, it was more than that. It's a symbol of my recovery and a way to give back." He described the run as one of the most meaningful moments of his life. Mr. Field said, "Completing the TAME 10K this year was one of the best days of my life. It felt like such a big achievement, and to do it with my friends and family supporting me was amazing." He was diagnosed in July last year following a routine NHS screening.
Sacked Formula One boss Christian Horner has been given a planning boost in his bid to enhance horse stables at his home in Oxfordshire. The beleaguered long-time Red Bull racing principal, who was replaced in his role recently, has been building an equestrian operation with former Spice Girl wife, Jerry Halliwell Horner. The celebrity couple are currently embroiled in a row with neighbours over plans to build a walker to exercise their horses that is still under consideration by the council. But a separate application to move gates to allow safer equestrian access at their country home has been given the green light. Mr. Horner, 51, had been in charge of the Red Bull team since its inception in 2005 and led them to several titles. No reason was given by the team, but his dismissal comes 17 months after accusations of sexual harassment and coercive controlling behaviour by female employee. He has been twice cleared of the claims, including an internal investigation and an appeal. The couple both remain embroiled in a row with neighbours over additional plans for a horse walker at the stables to exercise 8 horses. The celebrity pair own a horse racing company called OMBI and have built new stables for 14 horses at their Oxfordshire pad in Marston St. Lawrence near Banbury. But while the main proposal is still under consideration by West Northamptonshire Council, a secondary application for new gates and improved safety access for the horses has now been given the green light. The couple have employed a full-time trainer and their horses are all named after Mrs. Halliwell Horner's solo career hits.
A man on his way home from a life-saving training session found his new skills called on rather quicker than he'd expected. On his way home, Anthony Kershaw, a staff sergeant instructor with the Oxford Army Cadet Force, received a call from his wife telling him a young woman had collapsed outside the Wantage Health Center in Mabley Way Grove. Mr. Kershaw, from Wantage, arrived at the scene within minutes where he discovered the woman had a ligature tied around her neck. He cut this off, but her breathing didn't improve, so he began to give her the kiss of life and administer CPR with the help of an unnamed and off-duty nurse. Together, they carried on with the treatment, and by the time an ambulance arrived, the woman's condition was improving. Now Mr. Kershaw has been awarded a Royal Humane Society resuscitation certificate for saving her life and has also won the personal praise of Andrew Chapman, secretary of the society. "Fortunately, Mr. Kershaw was first aid trained and knew exactly what to do," said Mr. Chapman. "He took charge of the situation, cut the ligature which was choking the woman, and then began the fight to bring her back from the brink of death. He did a wonderful job and richly deserves the award he is to receive. This is one of many cases we see which emphasize the value of as many people as possible, not just members of the emergency services, learning how to administer CPR. It can, as it almost certainly did in this case, make the difference between life and death." The roots of the Royal Humane Society stretch back nearly 250 years. Other than awards made by the Crown, it is the premier national body for honoring bravery in the saving of human life. It was founded in 1774 by two of the day's eminent medical men, William Hawes and Thomas Cogan. Their primary motive was to promote techniques of resuscitation. However, as it emerged that numerous people were prepared to put their own lives at risk to save others, the award scheme evolved, and today a variety of awards are made depending on the bravery involved. The Society also awards non-healthcare professionals who perform a successful resuscitation. Since it was set up, the Society has considered over 90,000 cases and made over 220,000 awards. The Society is a registered charity which receives no public funding and is dependent on voluntary donations.
Armed police units stopped a van at gunpoint on a major Oxfordshire A road after occupants were seen with a rifle. The incident occurred on the A40 in Oxford at the slip road to Ellesfield at about 1:30 p.m. on Friday the 11th of July, when three police units, including armed officers, stopped traffic to intercept a van. Two men who were in the van were removed by police after a member of the public had reported seeing them load a rifle into the van. The weapon turned out to be a legitimately held air rifle, and no crime was committed. A police spokesperson said, Thames Valley Police received a call just after 1:30 p.m. to reports of a rifle being seen put in a vehicle near to the Marston flyover at Ellesfield. Armed units responded and intercepted the vehicle, which contained two occupants. The weapon was in fact a legally held air rifle, and once this was ascertained, the occupants were allowed on their way and no arrests were made. Our response was proportionate to the information initially received, and we gave words of advice to the occupants about displaying an air rifle and suitable ways to transport a legally held air weapon in a case. An eyewitness who was travelling on the A40 at the time of the incident said, My husband and I were driving from Headington to Summertown this afternoon and ended up in a pretty scary situation. We were headed westbound and noticed a police car behind us was purposefully slowing down traffic behind us. We realised why when we came upon the scene. There was another police vehicle blocking the road ahead, and in the intersection there were several men in tactical gear standing with high-powered rifles surrounding the van. There were multiple police vans and a large black unmarked SUV facing eastbound, which was stopped on the side of the road, and out of which a number of armed men in tactical gear with high-powered rifles got out. They were not 20 metres away from us, and the traffic was backed up behind us for a good 15 minutes or so. The road was reopened following the incident, and traffic quickly returned to normal levels. Although it appeared to the driver that the men were taken into custody, police confirmed that they were not arrested and were allowed to continue on their journey. Armed response vehicles are specialised units who respond to high-risk situations involving firearms or other serious threats. They are equipped with firearms and less lethal options, including tasers, and are trained in conflict resolution and de-escalation techniques.
Large crowds, including phantoms, animals, and princesses, marched down Whitney High Street for the annual carnival procession. This year, a musicals theme was decided upon by organizers, with the public taking inspiration from Disney films such as The Lion King and West End shows including Phantom of the Opera. Following the traditional procession through the town on Saturday, July 12th, the hundreds of attendees were able to enjoy live music, craft and trade stalls, as well as other fun activities. Entertainment including a fun fair, Zorbing, a bouncy castle, and the Toy Towers Express. There was a variety of food and drink on offer in the sweltering heat, such as crepes and pims. In addition, among the groups represented in the procession were representatives of the Whitney RAF Air Cadet Squadron and the town's Rotary Club. The city's Piano Festival is returning this summer, attracting some of the world's best performers. The Oxford Piano Festival is running from July 26th to August 3rd. The festival brings together some of the world's leading pianists for a rich program of masterclasses and evening concerts. Highlights include return appearances by acclaimed artists Víkingur Ólafsson, Nikolaj Lugansky, and Sir Stephen Howe, all renowned for their artistry and global concert careers. They also welcome distinguished pianists Sophie Piccini, Akiko Ebi, and Isada Kanamason to Oxford for the first time this year. The majority of the festival takes place at St. Hilda's College, with evening concerts held in historic venues across the city, such as Christ Church Cathedral and the Holywell Music Room, the oldest purpose-built concert hall in Europe. The festival's objective is to inspire, support, and encourage music making at the piano of the highest quality. Welcoming world-renowned soloists and teachers each year, the festival provides gifted young players with a rare opportunity to work alongside and learn from some of the world's finest pianists and teachers. For the full program and to book tickets, visit oxfordpianofestival.com.
The recent hot weather meant people seeking relaxation by water, whether sea, lake, or in the case of Oxford, by or in the river. This was a reminder of a much-loved book, The Wind in the Willows, by Kenneth Graham, who had such close ties with Oxford. He was a pupil at St. Edward's School, retired to Blewbury, and is buried in Holywell Cemetery, North Oxford. Here is a short reminder of his writing. The mole had been working very hard all the morning, spring cleaning his little home. First with brooms, then with dusters, then on ladders and steps and chairs, with a brush and a pail of whitewash, till he had dust in his throat and eyes and splashes of whitewash all over his black fur and an aching back and weary arms. It was small wonder then that he suddenly flung down his brush on the floor and said, "Bother!" and "Oh, blow!" and also, "Hang spring cleaning," and bolted out of the house without even waiting to put on his coat. He thought his happiness was complete when, as he meandered aimlessly along, suddenly he stood by the edge of a full-fed river. Never in his life had he seen a river before. This sleek, sinuous, full-bodied animal, chasing and chuckling, gripping things with a gurgle, and leaving them with a laugh, to fling itself on fresh playmates that shook themselves free and were caught and held again. All was a shake and a shiver, glints and gleams and sparkles, rustle and swirl, chatter and bubble. The mole was bewitched, entranced, fascinated. As he sat on the grass and looked across the river, a dark hole in the bank opposite, just above the water's edge, caught his eye, and dreamily he fell to considering what a nice snug dwelling place it would make for an animal. And a small face gradually attracted his notice. It was the water rat. Mole, soon to his surprise and rapture, found himself actually seated in the stern of a real boat. "This has been a wonderful day," said he, as the rat shoved off and took to the sculls again. "Do you know, I've never been in a boat before in all my life." "What?" cried the rat, open mouthed. "Never been in a... You never..." "Well, I... What have you been doing then?" "Is it so nice as all that?" asked the mole shyly, though he was quite prepared to believe it as he leant back in his seat and surveyed the cushions, the oars, the rowlocks, and all the fascinating fittings, and felt the boat sway lightly under him. "Nice? It's the only thing," said Water Rat solemnly, as he leant forward for his stroke. "Believe me, my young friend, there is nothing, absolutely nothing, half so much worth doing as simply messing about in boats. Simply messing," he went on dreamily. "Messing about in boats. Messing..." "Look ahead, rat!" cried Mole suddenly. It was too late. The boat struck the bank full tilt. The dreamer, the joyous oarsman, lay on his back at the bottom of the boat, his heels in the air. about in boats, or with boats, the Rat went on composedly, picking himself up with a pleasant laugh. In or out of them, it doesn't matter. Nothing seems really to matter. That's the charm of it. Whether you get away or whether you don't, whether you arrive at your destination, or whether you reach somewhere else, or whether you never get anywhere at all. You're always busy, and you never do anything in particular. And when you've done, it's there, always something else to do. And you can do it if you like, but you'd much better not. Look here, if you've really nothing else on hand this morning, supposing we drop down the river together and have a long day of it. I beg your pardon, said the Mole, pulling himself together with an effort. You must think me very rude, but all this is so new to me. So this is a river. The river, corrected the Rat. And you really live by the river. What a jolly life. By it and with it and on it and in it, said the Rat. It's brother and sister to me, and aunts and company and food and drink and, naturally, washing. It's my world and I don't want any other. What it hasn't got is not worth having, and what it doesn't know is not worth knowing. Lord, the times we've had together, whether in winter or summer, spring or autumn, it's always got its fun and its excitements.
And that was the last item for this week. Please note there is now a new telephone number for you to ring if you have any comments about this week's Oxtalk edition. Please ring 07496 062 280 and leave your name and contact details, as well as your message. Alternatively, you can email mail@oxtalk.org.uk. This edition and previous editions are available on our website, www.oxtalk.org.uk, where you can either listen or download. Thank you very much for listening.